In the Thick of It, a Profit and Loss podcast with Colin Lambert and Galen Stobbs.
Welcome to In the Thick of It, Profit and Loss's weekly podcast with P&L's editor Galen Stobbs and myself, Colin Lambert, managing editor of the magazine. And we have come back a week early just for you listeners, because you can't leave the foreign exchange markets alone for 5 minutes, can you, without something happening. There was we thinking it's been a nice quiet Christmas period, and no, all of a sudden, bang, we have flash moves. Just before Christmas, we had a PB blow up, Galen. Happy New Year to you and to all our listeners. Where to start? I mean, I guess with yesterday's events in the markets.
Yeah.
I guess it was interesting. Yeah, I mean, from my perspective, it was interesting because it was happening literally in my time zone as I was sitting here. You've kind of looked at it with that longer lens. What was the sort of comments when you sort of woke up yesterday and went through your emails?
So I found, so despite the fact that a lot of people were tying this to obviously the Amazon, the profit warning from Amazon, and that was kind of more broadly about linked again to kind of a slowdown in the Chinese economy, right? Which was for the first time in was it, I can't remember now, so 15 years or something, Apple was saying that it expects kind of its profits to decrease in China, which is obviously, this rapidly growing middle class, rapidly growing affluence. It's been, I think sometimes people forget, particularly during the global kind of recession, how much of a driver it was of economies in that part of the world that China was still growing. And, people have talked about the slowdown in the past, but, they've been talking about slowing down to, 6 or 7%, which is obviously GDP growth that most countries would kill for. So people were caught kind of wrong-footed for this, and I think while it was initially the price action we saw in certain currencies, particularly Aussie dollar and Japanese yen, well, that was kind of initially being linked to the Apple thing. I feel like some of the reports that I've read today that I've had a bit more time to digest it. Don't seem as enthused in making that link.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's an interesting one because, I mean, the Apple, I think it was the guys at InTouch FX noted in one of their reports that the Apple guidance, as it's now called, actually came an hour before this move. And the Chinese PMI data was a day before, I think it was, or even 2 days before. So I think they're probably right. The only thing I would say, though, is I do think that, and I think it was the first sort of downgrade since 2002 for Apple. And I think that sort of does unnerve people. And I wouldn't be surprised if it did sort of trigger to that risk off and then people get into their portfolios because nothing happened. Apple stocks collapsed in a heap. What was interesting to me was I was speaking to a couple of market makers yesterday just after the event. And I sort of, because someone said, oh, it's been a flash event. And being the most observant person in the world in early January in Australia, I had no idea. And I sort of went back, okay, what currency? So I can go and have a look on my charts. And it went everything. Every market went, which I thought was actually quite new. And that, to me, is like somebody going risk on, risk off in a very thin market. It's Australia again, let's get it right. It's a very thin market, but it's people going risk on, or in this case, risk off, in a very thin market. Because everything went, I do think Apple was a contributing factor. I just don't think it was the contributing factor. I think Ray Attrill at NAB down in Sydney has been analyzing markets for decades. He's one of the stalwarts of this market. And Ray talks a lot of sense. And he sort of turned around after a couple of hours and went, okay, I've done my analysis, and went, this is actually a liquidity event. This is not necessarily any particular trigger. It's just the fact that there's no liquidity. The signs, the ingredients were all there, I suppose. And so were the bits and pieces that make up a flash crash. Single dealer platforms apparently shut down pricing pretty quickly. You could only get volume done or business done on the primary venues. There weren't a lot of customer orders in there. There was a little bit of panic in there. And everybody immediately blamed the algos. What was interesting, I think, is that a few of the human traders I was talking to were saying they just saw it as a good opportunity. And I think this is where the manual traders have learnt from the flash crash of 2016, in that they turned around and said, actually, you know what? There is no real catalyst or fundamental reason for this 400-point move in the yen or 400-point move in the Aussie or 300-point move in the Aussie, sorry. Therefore, I'm going to come in and buy some. I'm going to try buying some here. And the minute someone puts a bid in the market, the algos pick up on it. And that's how you stop it. So to me, it was just a classic flash move.
So I spoke to one person, a senior figure at one prop trading firm, who had a slightly different theory, based largely on the timing of the event. So this was at this occurred at 5:22 p.m. U.S. time.
Mm-hmm.
And their view was that it came too long after the Apple news for there to be any real correlation there. They said if it was a result of the Apple news, it would have been more or less instantaneous. What they thought it was that they thought it looked like someone had basically reactivated systems and fat-fingered. So they talked about how for a lot of firms, there's kind of like IT window that changes at 5 p.m.
Yeah, there is. Yeah, between
time.
5 and 5:15. Yeah.
Exactly. This person was saying that for them, it was a little too coincidental that the timing was 5:52, which is literally, you know, when you're running the book, you shut everything down, it goes dark, and then it reopens 10 to 20 minutes later, you know, depending on the technology. So they thought it was, to them, it seemed a bit coincidental that it was just after everything comes back up that this had happened. So they suspected that it was a case of somebody fat-fingered, clicked the wrong button, and then as a result, it's, you know, the first week back in January, lots of people are still away, markets are naturally thin at this point, and so the impact was exaggerated, and that's what actually started the whole thing.
Yeah, the only thing I would say on that, though, is that looking at the trading and speaking to a couple of guys at platforms, you know, they're telling me that actually there was volume all the way down. With a fat finger trade, typically you tend to get that outlier trade, don't you? And it fills a lot of orders on the way through. These guys was telling me that actually there was business done all the way down. It was just, obviously, it's very, very quick. And it was a lack of price making that really exacerbated it. So that maybe, there may be something in there. I must confess, I tend not to look at it that way. I guess the other thing is, you know, what exacerbated it, and inevitably people are talking retail traders in Japan, because a lot of the time these things do happen and it involves retail traders in Japan, particularly around this time, because it gets near margin time for the Japanese. The fact is, if you look at it, you know, at first everyone thought, oh, it's a dollar move. You know, someone's just buying dollars for a risk off. But then you look at dollar yen dropping 400 points in a couple of minutes. And this happened on Brexit night as well. People forget that, you know, dollar yen suddenly had a 400-point gap on Brexit night as well. So Aussie yen, which is the favourite of every Japanese housewife, must have dropped something in the region of 600-700 points. Sorry, in the 60 to 70 points it would have been in that one. And there was a large move in Aussie yen, and people inevitably point to the Japanese retail for that. And I suspect what we're going to find is, if anybody does an analysis of this in authority, you know, with good data, I suspect what we'll find is they'll look at it and go, yeah, there was about seven or eight things happened within the space of an hour or two, and then someone just went, you know what, I don't like my position, get me out of here. It's an interesting one because Kit Jerks at Societe Generale, who is, you know, hands up, he's my favourite analyst to read, always entertaining, but he put out a thing on New Year's Day saying that how interesting it was that just about, you know, like a very high consensus in the 80s and 90s percent probably, was saying the dollar was going to go down this year. And at the time, dollar longs were at a recent high, according to CFTC data and so on.
Okay.
So it could also be there was something in that as well. You know, what small positions were there were there. To me, at the end of the day, I think the problem is that 1 hour or 2 hours after the US closes. It used to be back in the day, and I'm sorry to do this to everyone, but back in the day, there were trading books run from Los Angeles and San Francisco. There was two or three risk or liquidity providers in Wellington and Auckland. Now there's nothing. You know, there is that big gap between literally between New York close at 5 p.m. and with all due respect to Sydney, and I'm sitting in that fair city right now, you know, there's not a huge amount in this city either. So really, we've got this gap between the Tokyo Open and maybe the Singapore Open and the US Close. And I think it's becoming more of a problem because this is the second flash event we've had. You know, everyone told us after last night, we learned from all these things, there won't be any more flash events. Guess what, people? We've had another one and it's happening in the same window. So I do wonder whether at some stage we've got to look at it and go, what do we do with this window?
Wait, I don't know if I necessarily buy what you're saying. I agree that people said that they learned from this, but the message that I've got, I feel like speaking to people, is almost the opposite of we won't have more flash events. I feel like the message that I've got very much from people is that they're expecting the nature of liquidity in how the market functions today means that they're expecting more of these kind of mini flash events.
And I would agree with that. I just think, I guess, what I'm saying is, if you and I have done plenty of panels at our events where we talked about liquidity, and it's really tough to get anyone on stage to turn around and say, yes, I think there'll be more liquidity events, more flash events. Everyone tries to say, oh, no, it's fine, we learn from these things. And you do get that a lot from people. And I guess this is a problem between people speaking publicly and people speaking privately to you. Privately, I get exactly the same thing. Privately, people are nervous. And, you know, if you look at the single dealer platforms yesterday, I mean, it could be that some of them were actually in their closed-down window. To roll over to the next day. If that's the case, then that just makes it even more of a liquidity event because you suddenly had these liquidity sources drop out. It raises the question again, somebody, to get this move going, and this is accepting your fat finger theory, maybe true, I'm not sure I buy it, but it may be true, but somebody somewhere had to actually go in and execute the trades. It's the same with the Sterling flash crash in 2016. I keep on coming back to the same point. Somebody pushed cable from 126.30 below 126 a figure, and that's when the flash event happened. But somebody forced that market lower. And in this case, somebody has had to go in there and buy dollars and sell dollar yen and buy dollars against a range of currencies. Now, these guys tell me even the euro was gapping. That doesn't happen. What happens rarely. So, I do think there's something of an issue here they need to look at. And I come back to my thing maybe about central bank volatility bans. Even if it's only in place for these, if the market's going to be open in these hours and we pride ourselves in a 24, 5.5 market, clearly in a modern structure, it's difficult for the market to operate 24 hours a day. So there's got to be some protection put in, and I wonder if the idea is central bank volatility bans, where they turn around and go, okay, you know what, for those 3 hours, we're going to put bids and offers in 200 points away from each other, just in small, just to give the algos some comfort that they can price within that band.
So one question I wanted to get your reaction, which was, how do you think the market reacted to this in terms of, as you said, someone has to put in that bid, someone has to make that initial move, but granted that whether it's fat finger or bad trade or whatever, right, someone's half asleep at their desk, whatever happened, once that's happened, do you think that the market reacted okay?
I think the market reacted better than it did in 2016, which is a positive, and I think that could show that we are learning from these events, because I think to go back to my earlier point, there were a lot of manual traders out there who had a really good day yesterday. I was actually speaking to a guy yesterday who was on holiday, and he was absolutely distraught that he wasn't at his desk. And he's obviously on formal leave. So 2 weeks blackout, can't touch emails or anything like that. And he was absolutely distraught because there were guys in there going like, well, my budget is X. I just managed to buy dollar yen 400 points lower. And it's immediately bounced 200 points. And I've done that in Aussie and I've done that in Euro. So I think the market handled it well because the manual traders understood the opportunity from 2016. And obviously the move happened. And I guess it's because the bounce back came about 4 or 5 minutes later. It enabled people to look at it. I mean, A, you've got mean reversion in the algos anyway. But I just think the human traders were able to look at it, analyze it quickly and go, this is the same as 2016. And this time it didn't go 14 big figures. This time they let it go 4 and went, thank you very much. There's no reason for Aussie to be at 67.30. Let me buy it.
Yeah,
and they managed to kick him out at 69.5.
Speaking to people on my end, like, again, you know, slightly further away from all this, but generally, yeah. People I've spoken to said that they felt actually the market reacted fairly well. Yes, it was down four big figures, but they felt like it wasn't kind of that disorderly a move on a minute-by-minute basis, and then it recovered very quickly.
Yeah, I mean, I think ultimately it overreacts. The market overreacted, but then the foreign exchange market has a very long and proud history of overreacting. back in the 1980s, you listen to any central banker, they're always just banging on about how the foreign exchange market overreacts to everything, and dollar mark should have been 20 big figures lower over the year, and it was actually 30 because we all piled in that there's money to be made. It just happens quicker. That's the nature of markets. Everyone's trying to get through a very small door. It's an opportunity window. I thought overall the market handled it fairly well. And
you make a case that something happened, even if the catalyst wasn't obvious, like there was no obvious catalyst, like a Brexit or a speech or whatever. Even if the catalyst wasn't obvious, something happened, something changed, the market moved, but then price discovery happened, and it kind of it went back to the level it should have been at very quickly, which it didn't take long for that to happen, which is arguably the sign of a kind of a healthy market, that it was able to get back to fair value pretty quickly.
Yeah, I mean, I would say that if I'm looking at the Aussie in particular, if it closed the day something like 90 points below where it opened, and I would say given the concerns over the Australian economy, particularly housing market, given the slowdown in China, I would say that's a very fundamental move. The only problem was it went an extra 250 points in the initial crackdown.
Yeah.
And I think it comes down to the time of day. So I think, yes, it did handle it fairly well. The problem comes when you, and again, I come back to Japanese retail. If these guys have been wiped out on their Aussie yen carry trades again, then individuals are getting hurt by this. Now, personally speaking, I don't give a rat's, because if you want to play in a wholesale market, then you've got to obey the wholesale rules, and that means sometimes you're going to get hurt. But what worries me is that regulators are sitting there going, okay, we've got more mums and dads being hurt here. We might have to do something about this, which I don't think should be an outcome, because, to your point, I think the market handled it pretty well. Had the same thing happened 2 hours later, I doubt we would have had that sort of move. It's just this liquidity window where, well, frankly, liquidity doesn't exist. So it's a difficult one. We shall see. No doubt there'll be thousands of column inches pounded out about that by us and others over the next couple of months. It will actually be interesting to see whether the authorities think it worthy of an investigation the way they did in 2016. Or whether they'll just leave it to the research analysts. That could be an interesting indicator of what the authorities think of market events and markets suddenly going crazy. But, I guess, summarise, welcome to the world of equities. The more we equitise foreign exchange markets, the more of these moves we're going to get, where you get these random 7% drops, followed by a 5% rally, followed by a 2% drop, followed by a 4% rally. Net result, minus 0.5%. Total volatility, people wiped out all over the place. That's what happens if you don't have natural market makers.
And what happens if you add a zero onto all of those numbers is you get the cryptocurrency market.
Exactly. I mean, the crypto boys and girls are going like, I don't know what they're worrying about. What's all the fuss about?
Four big figures, what?
Exactly, yeah. That's my spread. I guess one of the upshots from this, I spoke to somebody yesterday who said, I said, look, how'd it go? And they went, it wasn't great. we did lose quite a bit of money as a market maker. But, it wasn't, it was probably, I think they said like it was a pretty small percentage of what their best day would have been last year. So, yes, they got hit, but it didn't hurt the firm in any way. And obviously it was the start of a long day, and as markets settle down, they can make a lot of that back. But obviously, we don't know if this has been an impact on a client out there. And just before Christmas, we had another event to consider, which was the Citi FXPB client. I wouldn't say blowing up, but should we say just having a few liquidity issues of their own. Obviously, we're going back a couple of weeks now, and I know this was actually the day before you went on your Christmas – or it was the day you went on your Christmas leave, wasn't it?
It was the day – I was actually technically on Christmas leave, but I was in for the P&L New York office Christmas party.
No, yes, I see. You're such a hero. Putting it out for the team.
I know, I know. Not all heroes wear capes, Colin.
Thank goodness. To just refresh what happened, there was the Hong Kong-based asset management unit of GF Holdings, which is Chinese, had a liquidity issue with some of their positions. They couldn't post margin, I think it was, and the cost to Citi could have reached $180 million. That's still to be found. Citi have relocated their prime brokerage business into prime finance and security services from FX. What was your take on it?
It's certainly not a great thing for the FX market at large, I don't think. Look, we've already talked a lot in recent years about how it has become challenging for a lot of firms to access PB services and access the credit that they need. I think in some cases, some people were getting these services that perhaps didn't need to be at an FX PB, or perhaps didn't belong there. That's kind of a separate argument. But kind of post SMB and post everything that happened there, Citi was, I don't think there'd be too much debate that Citi was kind of the biggest beast in the jungle when it came to FX PB. So I wonder what impact this will have on their... I don't want to kind of speculate too much on their kind of commitment to the business without knowing more of what's happening internally.
But the
natural reaction when you suffer something like a loss like that, and you make changes, are those changes going to have a big knock-on effect considering how big they are in the PB space for the FX market? Is what I'm saying.
Yeah, I think you've nailed it. I think I honestly think that's the single biggest question to come out of this. If it is 180 million or less, Citibank, in terms of FX business and their overall business, can just blink that away. That's not a huge issue. I think what you've nailed there is the real concern for the industry is what is the knock on effect. I mean, there were reports in the days afterwards that Citi was going to clients, and I spoke to one client and said, we had a phone call, but we're still there. But they were actually sort of raising the threshold of clients that they'd support. So again, they trimmed the clientele quite a bit, 2-3 years ago, I think it was. They're trimming the clientele yet again. The interesting one for me, I guess, do you think there could be any sort of knock on into sort of prime space? Because a lot of these prime primes do rely upon Citi. You're right, it's the biggest beast out there. I mean, there were people talking systemic concerns a couple of years ago before, I guess, people like Deutsche and Bank of New York came into it, and Deutsche re-entered, and UBS, kind of raised their game. Do you think if you're sitting at prime prime, you're sitting there concerned?
This comes back to one of the things we did in, I think it was the 2016 Q3 edition, where we did our Prime Services Special Report, which is Prime of Prime is such a broad umbrella term. I would say probably most of the what we'd consider the institutional grade, high quality Prime of Primes. I don't even quite know how to categorize them off the top of my head. But let's say that the top tier of Prime of Primes, I probably imagine aren't too worried. Because, they have... With the risk management tools they have, the capitalization tools they have, I think they're generally well situated. It's going to be it's going to be the ones at the kind of the bottom end of that who are still with Citi that are going to be the ones to go. It's not going to be the big prime of primes that are going to really. They might feel this in terms of whether it's raised margin requirements or. Just more onerous requirements generally, that might be something that they feel, but I think it's going to be the smaller players that get squeezed out.
The bigger prime of primes, they'll turn around and tell us actually that what they do, they reinforce the major prime brokers' risk frameworks, because they have a risk framework of their own. And they do their own due diligence, and they have their own monitoring, which actually adds in their argument adds an extra layer of defense. I guess it's the ones that are going to rely upon someone like Citi or the major PBs to do a lot of their risk management for them. They're the ones that are going to struggle, because obviously that becomes an onerous thing. At some stage, the bottom line looks at it. Someone in Citi's seen it on the board level goes, So really, do we want to worry about all these guys that we're doing this much work from our margins of this on them? Do we really care? So I think you're right. It probably would be at that smaller end. So I guess it's one to watch. I mean, you know, I think to City they've gone like, there's a one-off note for the accounts. We've relocated the business. It'll be run along the other lines. I guess by making it a broader business, you maybe lose that sort of personal touch. And as you say, that leaves some of the smaller clients perhaps looking somewhere else. And this could actually be, rather than a concern, this could actually be a real boost for the Prime industry, because they're going to be sitting there with open arms going like, yeah, come on in. And the fact is, any client can blow up at any time. And particularly when you're playing with, like, you know, these pivot accumulators and target redemption notes. Yeah, we've seen clients go to the wall or have big losses, particularly in Asia, with these before. I think it was like 2010, was it, when the Aussie blew up. And it just, I think the losses ran into the billions for clients in Asia, just on target redemption notes. So, yeah, anytime you're playing with these sort of derivatives, it becomes an issue.
I'm also sometimes a little skeptical. So they've obviously they've moved the FXPB business, which is currently part of FXLM. Will you know, this joining, as you say, Prime Finance Security Services. You know, the official memo said that you know, bringing its FXPB team into PFSS, a lot of acronyms in there, will position us to unlock. This is chock full of jargon. We'll position to unlock synergies across all markets, products, and ensure our clients are supported seamlessly for their important finance, operational, and transactional needs. I mean, so that kind of means that you know, it sounds like FXPB is being pushed into kind of broader Prime services, which comes under the broader OTC clearing business. I personally feel like, when that's happened before, it hasn't been roaring success. The first example of that springs to mind was when BAML kind of reassessed and reviewed and moved their FXP business into OTC clearing, which, as far as I could tell, involved the dismantling of most of the FXPB business it was.
Yeah. I'm just impressed that you actually understood all that rubbish in the PR speak, because she lost me at the first word. for those of you wondering about the strangle cry in the background, Liverpool just had an open goal opportunity and kind of missed it. So, live updates brought to you by P&L. Okay, so I guess we'll probably just, you know, we can end it around there. But one other thing I think we probably should note is that it's the other day was happy birthday to the Euro, 20 years old. It just ages you now when you're thinking, you know, there are people there that have never heard of a Deutschmark. It ages me, not you, the people there have never heard of a Deutschmark. I thought it was quite interesting. There was a lot of people out there saying, oh, yeah, the Euro's still struggling. Liverpool just scored. people are out there saying the Euro's still struggling. I thought we could just sort of close out with a bit of fun and we can have another one of our – we need a big drum roll for this P&L predictions. The Euro this year – let's have a prediction on euro dollar. It's currently trading at 1.14, the figure. I mean, I sort of look at it and go, yeah, people are saying it's on shaky ground. I find it interesting. The Deutschmark, to me, it's just a replacement for the Deutschmark. So I don't know why everyone thinks it's a new currency. In 1998, the Deutschmark had a 30% share of FX turnover. Last year, the euro had a 31% share of turnover. Not a lot's changed. So coming in, let's close out with a prediction for euro dollar at the 31st of December 2019. Do you want to go first or second?
I'll go second.
Righto.
Like, make sure I don't pick the same thing as you.
Yeah. I've already picked my number, mate. Don't worry about it. I am going to go. I actually think the US economy is going to have a really tough year. I think his Trumpness is going to have an even worse year than he thought and going to struggle. So I'm going to go 123.47.
Oof, that's good. I actually like that, because I agree. Trump's gonna have a bad year. We've got potentially like damaging politically reports coming out. Economy starting to sputter. Meanwhile, Britain's going to realize the whole Brexit thing was never really going to fly. The whole thing's going to fall apart. We'll decide just to stay in. It's going to lead to the euro roaring back up. So, see, I like the 120 to 125 range, but just because I've said that, I'm going to go in about 125 then.
Okay, 125 for you. If anyone remembers this on December 21st, then great. I'll even write my name and your name next to our predictions and try and leave it somewhere safe. On that note, wishing everyone a very happy and prosperous 2019. We'll be back next week as we get back into the year. Thanks very much for listening.